One of the things I think actually that's best about the holidays is gratitude. Similarly, enormous evidence about how just a simple gratitude practice, like writing down like two things you're grateful for every day, can go so far, everything from improving depression and anxiety, but also improving productivity. Like there's amazing research that shows, I think it's even when teachers do gratitude journaling, that their students end up with higher test scores. So I think so much of the holidays is around everything from Thanksgiving, Christmas, New Year's. It really gives a good opportunity to be grateful and also giving. I think giving is especially valuable. Either that could be giving gifts, that could be giving time or donations or even just random acts of kindness, like being in the grocery store. And when you check out, maybe you buy a gift card and give it to the grocery store clerk and things like that to help people see that you appreciate them. Those like random acts of kindness, those little small things that are very easy actually for all of us to do, but speak volumes. I think those can really make people feel a lot better.
You just heard from Dr. Nina Vossen, mental health expert and assistant professor of psychiatry at Stanford University School of Medicine. Hi there, I'm Celeste Headlee. Welcome to Women Amplified from the Conferences for Women. This podcast brings you conversations with some of the most brilliant minds around, and they have invaluable advice to offer, inspiration that might help you navigate life both in your career and at home. Today's episode is exactly what the doctor ordered as we head into the holidays. This is a time that often brings up feelings of sadness, loneliness, and stress during any normal year, let alone during 2020. But now is the time to celebrate you by prioritizing your self-care and your mental health. So Dr. Nina Vossen is here to share scientific evidence, universal approaches, and high-yield strategies that can help you achieve emotional well-being during this holiday season and all year round. Let's get started. How are you doing? You know, the people who have to take care of other people's mental states, I always wonder in times like this when they're surrounded by people in need, how are you doing?
Thank you very much for asking. It is true that we probably don't get asked that as much, and that a lot to pretty much everyone in our lives, right? Not only our patients, but certainly friends and family. And it means a lot to receive that question. Overall, I think I am definitely okay. If I think back over the year, there've certainly been more highs and lows and more lows than any other time in the last few years, for sure. But at the same time, to your point of, as someone who is taking care of those who are struggling, and I'm a practicing psychiatrist, and I see a range of patients, the majority of my patients are executives and entrepreneurs, but I also see folks from the whole spectrum in terms of socioeconomic background and issues that people are struggling with. And I have to say that while it definitely is hard when people are struggling, especially on those days where you see that there is either enormous struggle for one or two people or just kind of this collective, like low mood that you really feel is kind of permeating most of society. At the same time, one of the things that I find to be the biggest sources of like privilege and joy in the profession is that you do see the best of people come out. You see resilience, you see hope, you see amazing ability to overcome adversity. And so I think that when I see my patients, I find myself really focusing on that instead, where it helps to give a really positive outlook on life, on what all of us are capable of, and of keeping that spirit there that despite the huge, huge struggles and challenges our entire world has faced this year, that we are resilient, right? We've evolved evolutionarily over the last, you know, thousands and thousands of years to be strong. And that's what I'm seeing.
We hear a lot that the holidays are particularly difficult for people from a mental health standpoint. And I wonder how that's different in 2020. It could be that people are not having the added stress of having family over or cooking for a large group of people. But what do you expect in this holiday season when it comes to people's state of mind?
That's a really important question. So when we think about the reason why mental health exists, the model that we use is called the biopsychosocial model. And what this represents is the three main buckets of what contributes to health being any place along the spectrum that it is, from great to horrible. And what that breaks down into is biobiological, psychological, and social, which is a mix of like social and environmental. So if we think about those three areas, biologically, the reason why, or one of the reasons why the holidays are especially stressful is around something, if we think about something like seasonal affective disorder, the weather changes and that changes the way our brain is reacting, and the neurotransmitters that are going through our brain certainly have different biological levels when it's rainy or when it's snowing, or, you know, just that kind of overall sense of what the world looks like. From the psychological perspective, one of the hardest things that happens around the holidays, and again, this is the holidays in general, and then I'll get to what's going on uniquely this year. When it comes to the holidays, there's such a image out there of the holidays being perfect. When we look at the Hollywood movies and even stories that we grow up with, the holidays are supposed to be this beautiful, magical time. And the reality, especially this year, is that families fight. Relationships are hard. You might not get the bonus you're looking for. I know at Stanford, no one's getting their annual kind of bonus or any kind of even raise, period. And so the expectations and the change and the difference in reality and expectations is highest around the holidays than any other time, because you would think and you hope and you're kind of told by all these external signals and cues that you're supposed to be happy. And so if you're not then feeling that way, or if there's some disappointment, like you have an argument with your partner or your parents have different expectations, then all of that ends up really weighing on you, because the image you imagine and the image that you might even have been hoping for and looking forward to in September, October, November, it doesn't actually happen. So that disconnect ends up leading to a lot of psychological damage and difficulty. And then finally, we have the social. When we think about the social, we think of social, environmental, historical, and a little bit of those areas. And what happens there is that you're having multiple opportunities to feel better. You're maybe putting up the Christmas tree or caroling or going to a series of holiday parties. And that's kind of what your environment looks like. Some of the things that actually end up being especially hard around the environment actually are related to substances. We see a big increase in drinking, in using other substances like marijuana or other recreational drugs. And while that ends up maybe having a short-term benefit, or I shouldn't say benefit, but, you know, make someone feel better in the short term, in the long term, all of these really end up worsening depression, worsening anxiety. So that's why we realize that the holidays are especially hard for people. And then to get to the second part of your question around what's different this year, many, many things. I think that it depends on who you are and what brings you joy. I'll give myself an example. You know, I'm very extroverted. And so I love being able to go to parties and meet new people and reconnect with past friends and everything. And even I love throwing parties. Throwing parties is one of my favorite things, period.
Me
and
too.
Hostessing. Yeah. And to have that taken away, or to only be able to do it for one or two people instead of like 10, 20, 50, 100 people. For me, that was always one source of joy and something I really looked forward to. And that's been taken away, right? And for everyone now across the country, across the world, things that normally had helped us stay resilient, or when times were tough over the holidays, the ways over the years that we've learned to cope have been taken away. Whether that's going to a movie by yourself and watching something that makes you feel happy through these parties. I'll wrap that up with one thought, which is around hope. And one of the things that I think the holidays are just so classic for is the sense of hope. And hope ends up being really, really important. We actually see that the brain changes in terms of the brain chemistry. And when people are hopeful, endorphins get produced. And that ends up leading to an improved sense of well-being, and overall, people end up being more calm, more open and everything. And this year in particular, I think for a lot of people, they felt both a sense of decreased hope as well as just like chronic uncertainty in a way that we've never had to experience before. So those two things in combination, it's almost like the things that were positive have been kind of temporarily removed. And then we've had all these added kind of negative stressors, which has made it very, very hard.
Over the past year,
I'm sure you have watched the decline in mental health measures on a broad scale. And I wonder if that also concerns you at least a little for the holidays, because I'm sure that many people are either not going to therapy because they have lost their job, maybe they've lost their healthcare, maybe they have reservations about seeing a therapist, and maybe it's just that they don't want to use Zoom and in-person appointments aren't available. And so you have sort of a bad combination of mental health measures declining and people not seeking help. What kind of advice can you give people on how to take care of themselves?
Yeah. Well, first of all, you're absolutely right. I'm very, very concerned about what's going on right now. We're seeing rates almost double across the board, and especially in racial minority communities, in particular, the Black and African American communities, as well as in some cases, the Latinx communities and Asian communities. We're seeing even higher 3x increase in certain conditions. And certainly this overlap with what we've experienced this year around systemic racism and brutality and everything. And it's very concerning just seeing these unprecedented rates. At the same time, what I actually would say is while there are absolutely folks who have lost their health insurance and who are not seeking care, what I actually have seen for an overall trend is one of the silver linings actually that myself and others in the field have talked about this year is that we've seen a huge acceleration in stigma decreasing. I give this example that I start my day with the New York Times, and before coronavirus, there would probably be an article on anxiety or stress or some mental health issue on the front page, maybe once a week, but probably not even that. Versus now, it's really almost every single day that I see something, whether it might be the parenting section or the well section, or even just overall health science society, that people are talking about struggling with mental health at levels that they never were before. And not just, you know, general kind of broader society, but people who are influencers, right? And everything from celebrities to politicians. And when these messages are then getting out there that much more, what I'm pleasantly surprised to see is people being a lot more willing to say, I'm struggling, I'm having a hard time, and taking that next step of, and I think I need to get help. I think that right now, what help has looked like for a lot of people is just talking about it, which is a really, really important first step. I hope that what can happen in the coming months is to see more like really getting kind of the serious professional care that is so important. And I think everything that you brought up around if the financial resources are lower or people have Zoom fatigue and there are a whole host of reasons why people may not seek help. What I do think I've seen is those who already had sought out help seem to be actually doing a good job of staying consistent. And in fact, one of the statistics I've been sharing with people is that in my own practice at Stanford, I have both a practice at Stanford and a private practice. My private practice rates are usually great. People will come almost all the time. But at Stanford, the no-show rate used to be anywhere from like maybe 10, 20%. Sometimes I'm in sunny Palo Alto. And so sometimes when it was raining or things like that, it would be even lower as people were less likely to leave or be outside. But since coronavirus started, I've really had like almost a 99, 100% attendance rate. So to me, that's a really good sign that, as I said, people who are already engaged in the system seem to be doing a good job of continuing. But how do we get people who have never been a part of the healthcare system? How do we help them get care? And we can talk about that in a little bit.
Well, we might as well just talk about it now. And I wanted to start by talking about the things that perhaps people do that make it worse. In other words, a friend of mine, a neighbor of mine, has been to the doctor several times for sleep disruption. She's extremely stressed out. She's not sleeping well. And because she's in this state of stress, she's doom scrolling. she's constantly checking her social media feeds, which is only raising her stress levels. And as her stress levels raise, that makes her more afraid, makes her feel more dread. And then what does that do? It pushes her to doom scroll more. So what advice do you have for people who may be caught in that kind of vicious cycle of their fear pushing them toward habits that in the end are not going to improve their mental health or their well-being?
Yeah, that's so important. And doom scroll, you know, there are a few words that are certainly becoming the words of 2020. And I think that unfortunately, doom scrolling is absolutely one of them. And it's so bad, especially before falling asleep. It's this cycle of, I can't fall asleep, so I need to find something to do. Let me, you know, get my phone. And so not only are those lights on, and I mentioned earlier about the biological, psychological, and social, the lights being on makes it hard to fall asleep. Then what you're reading triggers all these emotions or thoughts that make it hard to fall asleep. And then the addiction of keeping scrolling and doing more and more, all of these just exacerbate it and really put you on a downward spiral. That's one thing that I've certainly seen. And actually, just to go back in terms of the problems, what we've especially seen is like 2x increases, if not more, in, I would say, the biggest things I've seen: depression, anxiety, substance use. And when we think about symptoms of trauma, both where folks had past traumas that have now kind of come back to the surface, as well as this almost like collective societal level trauma that we're facing. And then finally, like the one symptom I've seen that just seems to have become the highest rates I've ever seen before is specifically insomnia. And that's difficulty falling asleep, staying asleep, or early morning awakening. And the good thing, I'll actually just start with insomnia, because this is, I think, what your friend is struggling with. Usually there's a big link between insomnia and anxiety. They kind of end up being cyclical. But one of the best things about insomnia is actually there are a whole host of things that people can do to help. I'll go back to that biopsychosocial model, because that's really how we think about not only why you're struggling, but also how to get better. Biologically, melatonin is something that you can buy over the counter and one of the safest medications we have out there. And taking a little melatonin before falling asleep can make a big difference in helping you kind of calm down. Why I really like sleep as a problem is because there are so many behavioral changes that people can make. Everything from taking a bath or a shower before falling asleep. And what we see is like the change in temperature ends up leading to the body kind of starting to shut down. Candles like lavender and jasmine that are calming and help you fall asleep. Journaling, especially I think when you're having anxiety, journaling ends up being an incredibly helpful tool, because then instead of ruminating and having these thoughts going in spirals in your mind, you're actually able to write them down and process them a little bit better. And what that comes to is the kind of thing, the last thing I'll say about that is just being a lot more aware of what you're dealing with and why. That awareness, which you can get through something like mindfulness meditation, you can get that through journaling, or even something like prayer, ends up being one of the best things you can do, because it's really just you being in tune with yourself and understanding more about the thoughts and emotions you're experiencing. So I would definitely recommend that to everyone. I think that's tremendously important. And then to the other issues, just in terms of the things that, especially around the holidays, end up being highest yield, substances are something, especially if we think of something like alcohol, there are a lot of jokes, certainly. I mean, I think since quarantine started, you know, the quarantini and all those sorts of things around people kind of, you know, jokingly and seriously, like talking about how they're drinking more, or maybe I'm in California, so there are a lot of people who are using different cannabis products a lot more. And the concern there is that one, people who do have an addiction, the holidays end up being especially difficult, because in a lot of ways, we make it socially okay to be using and to be using at levels that aren't really quite healthy, as well as then for people who might not have, quote, an addiction issue, still that overuse can end up being pretty toxic. And as I said, like in the long run, end up not helping. Even if we take something like alcohol, initially, alcohol makes you sleepy. But as it breaks down over a couple hours, then it actually ends up being almost more like a stimulant. So you end up actually having very poor quality of sleep, because you're not entering those deep sleep phases. And a lot of people drink right before going to bed, right? Or most people are drinking in the evenings. And so it's kind of like the worst time actually to be doing that when we think about something like sleep.
You're listening to a conversation with physician, professor, and pioneer in mental health technology, Nina Vasan. Limited tickets are still on sale, by the way, for the Massachusetts Conference for Women on December 10th. It is the first ever virtual event and offers a lineup of brilliant and incredible women, including Alicia Keys, Awkwafina, and Doris Kearns Goodwin. To learn more and to register, you can visit maconferenceforwomen.org. Now let's get back to our conversation. I wanted to go through some of the other things that people can do, and maybe I should phrase them in the things that they're doing that are not helpful, because I'm seeing this all around me right now. For example, a number of my friends are very stressed out right now, very anxious. They're turning down phone calls. They're only texting or emailing. Also, I'm seeing some horrible eating habits. I've seen people's exercise routines fall straight into the trash bin. There are two things here, right? There's the things that people are doing that are possibly making their well-being go down. And perhaps there's another column of things that they could be doing to increase well-being. Could you go through some of those things?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you're right that it is just sort of the same topics end up being both the things that help you get a lot better, as well as all of these topics, which I'll review. They are all behaviors. And even if we just think of something like exercise, right? Like, yes, exercise, if you were to ask me, like, what are the three best things, I would say exercise, sleep, and mindfulness. And what that comes down to is that these are the things that we have the absolute best scientific evidence for as being incredibly helpful from head to toe, really. And moreover, no matter who you are, whether you're severely depressed or you're just a smidge socially anxious at times, these are the things that really help everyone across the board to get better. And so when you're doing it, that's great. And then exactly as you're saying, when you're not doing it or when it was a part of your life and you've kind of given up on those things, it really does end up taking a toll. The areas that I think are most important, as I said, exercise would certainly be number one. In this setting, that's why, in fact, when people are talking about why they're so stressed this year or what's been hard this year, I suppose maybe almost pleasantly surprised at how many people say, like, not being able to go to my gym. I'm here in Silicon Valley and there are a lot of frisbee players at the tech companies. And I've heard a number of people talking about how their frisbee league, Ultimate Frisbee League, is no longer in play. And that's something that they really miss out on. So when it comes to exercise, there's both the actual physical part of exercise, but also for a lot of people, it's socializing, right? It's like maybe you do SoulCycle with a couple friends and that's like one of your top social events of the week. So losing that and now having to either exercise at home or do Zoom videos, or maybe it's being able to like jog around the neighborhood. Those are so, so important. As I said, like the only like silver bullet, if you will, I think that we probably have in the field of healthcare is exercise. And then number two I'll jump into is mindfulness meditation, where I recommend apps like Calm and Headspace to people because they make it really easy to do mindfulness meditation. It's really remarkable how helpful that ends up being. Sleep, again, going to be number three. And I think that exactly as you were saying, that with things like doom scrolling, it's become really hard to prioritize sleep. One of the things I recommend to people is if you Google sleep hygiene, you'll get a load of tips, everything from decreasing the temperature of your bedroom to like high 60s, low 70s, or having blackout shades or earplugs and little really simple things like that that actually end up making a really big difference for a lot of people in being able to sleep better. So that's another thing I would mention. You talked about nutrition. Nutrition is actually one of the still underappreciated facets that contribute phenomenally to our overall well-being and health on a daily level, as well as, of course, on the big picture scale. And yeah, I mean, I certainly, you know, I've been in line at CVS or even Whole Foods where things are supposed to be healthy and seen like the processed food, the increase in processed food.
Right, an entire cart full of barbecue chips.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. I'll confess myself, I love William Sonoma peppermint bark, and now is the exact time that it's been released. And so I totally like saw yesterday, I'm like, ooh, it's on 20% off, so maybe I should buy more of it. Because there's definitely an emotional eating component to that peppermint bark that's bringing happiness. So anyway, I just wanted to get the point of tips. I think tips are so, so helpful. We talked about mindfulness, sleep, nutrition, substances, exercise. One of the things I think actually that's best about the holidays is gratitude. Similarly, enormous evidence about how just a simple gratitude practice, like writing down like two things you're grateful for every day, can go so far. Everything from improving depression and anxiety, but also improving productivity. Like there's amazing research that shows, I think it's even when teachers do gratitude journaling that their students end up with higher test scores. So much of the holidays is around everything from Thanksgiving, Christmas, New Year's. It really gives a good opportunity to be grateful. And also giving, I think giving is especially valuable. Either that could be giving gifts, that could be giving time or donations, or even just random acts of kindness, like being in the grocery store. And when you check out, maybe you buy a gift card and give it to the grocery store clerk and things like that to help people see that you appreciate them. Those like random acts of kindness, those little small things that are very easy actually for all of us to do, but speak volumes. I think those can really make people feel a lot better.
What can we do if someone we know and care about is struggling? What's the best way to help someone else?
Yeah. I'd actually love to ask you, in your own experience, what have you seen to be helpful?
I ask them what they need. And I say, listen, I'm not asking you rhetorically. Do you want to come over for dinner? Can I clean your house for you? That's basically what I've been doing. I put up a little food pantry outside my house, a little free food pantry. It's just those little things.
First, I love that. That's absolutely phenomenal. And that is the exact answer. You nailed it. It really is asking people. And part of it is, you know, not everyone has insight into what they need, but a lot of people do. And moreover, for example, assuming that they want to like problem solve what's going on, it might just be they just need someone to listen, right? Or that they recognize they've kind of hit a level that's lower than they ever had before. And they do, maybe they actually need someone to like hold their hand as they seek professional help. Asking is definitely the single best first thing to do. And really, really listening, right? Whether that's listening to what they're saying or just being there to hear what's going on. Now, you know, the first thing you asked me, how am I? And especially as someone who is hearing mental health kind of struggles and challenges on a daily basis, it's important too for you as an individual to make sure to put your own self-care, to prioritize that, right? And to make sure that as you are hearing about friends and family and loved ones, their struggles, that it's not getting you down. Because you're, you know, just like we sort of say that, you know, in the plane, you put the mask on yourself first, right? Because you have to take care of yourself first before you can take care of others. So I think that's definitely important. But one of the things, back to the question of like, how do you help your loved one? Asking first, absolutely listening. And then in the most, I think, you know, destigmatizing way possible, being able to really help talk through, especially if you're worried. One of the first things that we do as professionals is what we call triage. We try to figure out, is this person, even if we think of the spectrum from illness to wellness, where on the spectrum do they lie? And what is the urgency with which they need to get help? And in particular, if someone is really, really low, like it looks like they're at one of the lowest points that you've seen or that they've been, and or you hear things that really concern you for their safety, for their health, that's when it's really important to act urgently and do so in a way that's supportive. The final thing I'll add to that is what I've seen actually over the last few years, especially within families, is a lot of times mental health doesn't get talked about in families. And being able to share one's own experience, whether that is with kind of a diagnosed mental health condition, or even just if it's I get really anxious before my quarterly reviews at work or something. But being able to talk about it and to share one's own vulnerabilities end up, I think, going a long way to then make whoever you're talking to feel safe to share on a deeper level. So I do think, you know, self-disclosure is something that everyone has their own level. I myself talk very openly about my own struggles with depression and anxiety. And that's something I've specifically chosen to do. And not everyone wants to do that. And certainly it's important for everyone to do what's right for them and their own comfort levels. But I do think that even in my own experience, the feedback and reception that I've gotten is that when I disclose myself, the depth of conversation end up getting a lot deeper, a lot quicker, I think, because that sense of safety is there.
Before you go, for my last question, I wanted to give you a chance to talk about REAL. And I wanted to end here mostly because it seems like a good gift to give someone if you have that kind of relationship with them. I mean, I'm just thinking about all of the harried, fraught, anxious people around me.
Yes.
Can you tell me what REAL does and why you've launched it?
Yeah, absolutely. I would love to. And it's funny you mentioned that because literally, I think just a couple of days ago, we did launch a give the gift of mental health, basically like a gift card sort of offering.
It's a good idea.
And it's definitely tricky. I can see a lot of memes or things on Instagram that are making fun of like, here, like I'm giving you mental health services, but very seriously. We've created gift cards that allow you to give anywhere, I think from like 1 month to 6 months of membership into REAL. And for those, you know, who don't know, REAL is a digital on-demand mental health kind of both service and community. And I can kind of talk through what that means. So let me go back to actually explain, like when it comes to mental health and mental health services, there's certainly a wide range of digital products out there. There are things like Talkspace or BetterHelp or different apps and all that are offering different things. And the problem, the reason why we realize that we need to be able to offer something different is that one is quality. The quality of a lot of, especially the more affordable things out there, is just not very high or consistent. So what people end up feeling is like, oh, I could have just asked my friend this. Is this actually scientifically evidence-based? Am I actually getting the best data and kind of scientific understanding of what's out there to help me get better? And the reality is a lot of the kind of more affordable options out there, the quality is just not that high. The second thing, though, is access, which is that one of the biggest issues, one of the biggest hurdles in mental health care is going to your doctor once a week or once a month, and pre-coronavirus, like probably taking 2 or 3 hours out of your day in order to make that appointment. And so the issue of access, I think both it comes down to cost of being able to offer something really low cost, and Real is actually less than $1 a day, which is the least expensive or most affordable mental health service that certainly I've ever seen. And definitely when you think of the kind of costs of therapy, you know, therapy sessions can range from $100 to like $400, $500 in certain areas like New York. And so it really, for what you might pay for like one session, you can end up getting 6 months of care. So access, as I said, one is cost, and two is just convenience, right? Which is if you're having an appointment at 2 p.m. every Thursday, and you're a working mom, it's very, very difficult to make that appointment. And so one of the first things that we wanted to be able to do with Real is kind of like choose your own adventure, not only what you engage in, but being able to do it on your own time. So there are three main offerings that we have. The first and kind of primary is what we call Pathways. And what that is it's anywhere from a 6 to 12 week program, almost like a course on a specific area of mental health. And that could be anything from anxiety or depression to something like sexuality, or one of the most successful groups that we've just had is specifically a career-based pathway for women of color. And what's interesting that we're seeing is what you'll hear is there's that specificity. It's like being able to choose a specific problem that you know you're dealing with, and then being able to engage with curriculum created by a therapist that allows you to learn both the kind of theoretical as well as the practical steps to get better, as well as do things like reflection exercises so that you can really apply it to your own life. And what's been actually amazing is we've already seen like very kind of statistically significant and clinically significant improvements in people's health in just a very short amount of time.
Wow.
Which I think is certainly showing that things are working. People are going from like being moderately or severely anxious to being normal by engaging in one of these. So that's been really promising. The other two things, one is what we call like a salon series, which is group therapy essentially around particular topics, where community and connection, I think, are one of the most important elements of overall mental health and well-being, especially at this time of coronavirus and quarantine. So that has ended up to be a really wonderful offering for folks, as well as we have open events where people can even bring a friend and just talk about a lot of topics. I've been speaking with people around medication or topics like ADHD or seasonal affective disorder. We had like election town halls for people who are struggling with election anxiety, as well as how do I talk to my parents when they have a completely different political affiliation from me and things like that. So what's been great about it is, as I said, one is this super low cost, which I think just allows you to test it out in a way that it's hard sometimes to even test out like a session of therapy, as well as the convenience of doing it on your own time. But then finally, I think it just goes down to quality and offering things where we know scientifically these work for most people and delivering it in a way that's really easy to access.
Okay, well, I mean, I think it looks good as a gift, and I may end up giving it to my neighbor who can't sleep. I mean, I think I wish everyone better improved well-being, not just through the holidays, but next year as well. And I want to thank you so much. I mean, very, very practical advice here. So thank you so much for joining us and sharing your wisdom on better mental health, but also just better lives.
Oh, good. I'm so glad. Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. And I really appreciate you covering this topic. I really have had a number of patients who are talking about struggling around the holidays. And I think being able to listen to this and realize that this is something that so many folks are dealing with will really help people get better.
Well, I appreciate your time. Thanks so much, Nina. And that was nationally recognized expert on mental health and chief medical officer of Real, Dr. Nina Vassen. To learn more about Dr. Vassen and this incredible new digital on-demand mental health platform, visit join-real.com. If you enjoy this podcast, and I know you do, please share it with others. We could all benefit from some great advice and inspiration right now. The Conferences for Women is the largest network of women's conferences in the nation. They draw more than 45,000 women and men to annual events in Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, Texas, and now an all-new conference in California that debuts March 4th. Very exciting. You can learn more about that and all of our events at conferencesforwomen.org. I'm Celeste Headlee, and this is Women Amplified for the Conferences for Women. Thank you so much for spending this time with me. Be kind and be well.